Were you apprehensive? How did you feel about it, you know, as you were going up, before you got into that first day of combat? What thoughts went through your mind?
Well, having been raised in a small town in a close knit, we were very sheltered. All of a sudden you're out in a wide world, and barely 19, I really was kind of, I guess the word apprehensive, I was probably more scared than I was anything. Because I honestly thought I was going to get some more training. All of a sudden, from one day to the next, you're right out there, you're considered either kill or be killed. And fortunately, we'd had some good instruction at camp by a ranger who landed on Omaha Beach. And he came to our camp in California at Camp Roberts and said, if you guys listen to what I say, you're more apt to come back on your 2 feet rather than in a box. And he said, over there, it's kill or be killed. He said, which one do you want to be? So, yeah, I was scared because I didn't realize that next day we're going to jump off. So all of a sudden, reality set in, and the real world happened the very next day. You know?
The two guys who were with you in that foxhole, how were they killed? Do you remember their names?
Or
did
you? Absolutely. I trained with one of them at Camp Roberts. His name was Robert Roper, and the other fellow's name was Irving Wigton. I have a picture of the honor roll that we honored at after the war. We had all their names on a big plaque that we put out in our company area. Robert and I trained he was from Los Angeles and I was from the Fresno area. Irving Wigton had come from Alaska. He'd served in the anti-aircraft up there, and when that kind of subsided, why, they needed infantrymen after the Bulge. You know, we suffered over 80,000 casualties there. So it wasn't hard to figure out where they were going to send you. The infantry needed people bad. So Irving and Roper and I, we got off the truck together, and they said, you three guys go sit in that church over there, and there'll be some guy come and get you after dark. So we sat in this bombed out church. I say bombed out. Probably artillery, because we had seesawed back and forth for 5 days in that town before it was secure. So we sat in this church, and you hardly knew it was a church, except sitting there long enough you could pick out where the altar was and some of the other stuff, but it was just walls. And about dusk, well, it was dark already because it was wintertime, so the sun set early. A guy, come old scruffy guy, came in there and he says, you guys follow me. And Irving wore real heavy glasses, thick lens glasses, and I had just met him then because we on the truck. So as we got ready to walk out, this guy said, I want you guys to don't say a word, and says, you just follow me. And we start following him out of town a ways, probably maybe a block at the farthest, but it was pitch black. And Wigton said, I can't see where I'm going. And I turned around, I said, Irvin, I said, just hang on to my belt, you'll be all right. And I didn't realize it. I thought, why did they send this guy up to the infantry that can't see?
In the dark.
And in the dark, he said, I can't see anything. So he hung on to my belt, and we got up close to the pillbox. I didn't know where we were going, but this sergeant said, told us to shut up. And we got up close to where we were going to be in this pillbox, and the guard stopped and asked for the password. And I don't remember, but we always used a two phrase like Clark and Gable or Marilyn Monroe, something like that, as a two name. And one would say Clark and the other would say Gable. And we heard the password, so he opened a big old steel door and we shuffled inside this pillbox. The walls were dripping wet because some of our infantry guys had put one of those Molotov cocktails in the ventilation system, blew out everything there, so the walls became just wet, the water was just running down the walls, and it was damp, and you could smell, I think we smelled the Germans who had been there before, and like us, they never got their baths or showers or clean, so there was a lot of stink. And I thought, man, this is an awful way to start out, you know. But the Sergeant Mueller, he made us feel right at home. But you asked about these two gentlemen. On our 10th day, which was February the 19th, we were taking a hill, and as we got up on top, the sergeant said, "Dig in." And Roper and I were foxhole buddies. We always buddied up together. I forget who Wigton dug in with. But just the prior day, the sergeant always had a runner with him who either carried the little short walkie-talkie, and they always stuck together because the runner was used to go back and report either to an officer or go back and get orders or get a map, whatever. And I'll remember him forever. His name was Shorty Markham. And the sergeant said Shorty's going to take a few days R&R, go back and kind of clear his head. And for some unknown reason, and I only have to say the good Lord was watching over me, the sergeant came to me, and in 10 days I didn't even know his name, but he said, "Schmidt," he said, "I want you to take Markham's place." He said, "You carry this radio and your M1 and you stick with me." Well, we got on top of this hill, and there was one foxhole that the Germans had previously dug, and it was big enough for about three people, and it had logs on top and dirt on top of that, so from the top you had pretty good protection. And of course the sergeant crawled in the hole there, and he says, "You come in here with me and take care of the radio, and if I need you, you're right here." But we no more than got in the hole, and the others were digging, and obviously with that foxhole the Germans had been there shortly, so they had direct observation on us from somewhere which we weren't aware of. And in just a few moments, two 88 shells came in and with a tree burst timed to explode above and rain down, and Irving Wigton and Robert Roper were both digging in, and I believe to this day Robert never knew what hit him. He was literally cut to pieces. Just, you scared the daylights out of it. And Wigton got up and hollered for medic, and then collapsed, and both of them died right there. And then we had a machine gunner, a fellow by the name of Estep, was with us that day from, obviously from Heavy Weapons Company, which would have been, I don't know, maybe H Company. Generally it was a lot last of the battalion. And he was killed. We had lost three fellas killed, and meanwhile I was in the hole with the sergeant, and we heard the medic, and he said, "I've got a guy, can I bring him in there?" Well, we were already three of us in there. They brought this guy in. Man, he had taken a piece of shrapnel, one in his calf of his leg. It was part of his leg was part of it was gone, and part of his boot, the back part of his heel of his boot was just gone. And he said, "Schmidt, will you help me?" Again, I had 10 days in combat and I hardly knew what to do. But your immediate thing was, "Well, help him." And the medic was doing all he could, and he said, "Well, help get his boot off and help hold him." And he gave him first aid. I looked and saw part of his heel gone. Stuff like that for a 19-year-old kid. And having just lost Roper, and it was tough. We walked away from there. It was like part of the world went away. And you just kind of walked away. Said, man, one minute they're here, the next minute they're gone. Life was tough. I was fortunate. I escaped that one.
But did you think at that point or thereafter that any minute that could happen to you?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yeah. In fact, at that very same time, after things quietened down a little bit, the sergeant said, "Schmidt," he said, "go down and get the captain." And I said, "Well, where is he?" He says, "He's in that barn down there where we started up the bottom of the hill." So I took my M1, left the radio there, I took my M1, and I started off down the hill. And the Germans had this rocket machine handled, it would send out six rockets called a screaming beamy.
The Nebelwerfer.
The Nebelwerfer. They had a siren to their sound. They were probably psychologically scared the daylight out of you. And I started out down the hill down to get the captain, and one of these shells came right over and I hit the dirt. And we had been told, if the first one lands beyond you, you can get up and walk, because every succeeding one would go just a little bit farther. So I reasoned that the first one, I said, Nas, did that thing really go over me? So I laid there, and the next one came, and I could hear it whizzing, so I knew it went over. So I got up and walked. But that thing walked me down all the way, but each one went a little bit farther. But I hit the dirt, I don't know how many times. I got down to the captain, and my M1 was full of mud on the, you know, where the muzzle is there. And he literally chewed me out because of this dirty weapon. And of course, in training, we were taught that M1 had to be clean, spick and clean. You could stick your fingernail in the breech and look on the other end, and you could just see nothing but a shiny finger there. I couldn't even see through the barrel. It was so full of rust. But the M1 was a wonderful weapon. It never missed a beat. But I got down there, and he chewed me out, and I'm only a 10-day-old kid in this man's army. I just took it, and he said, what are you here for? I said, I was sent down to get you. And he said, well.
What did he say?
He said, how do you get back up there? I said, well, I know how I got down here. I said, that's how I'm going back. He said, not me. Mm-hmm. And he went around a long way to come up there. And anyway, from there on, we had some tough going.
The captain's name, do you remember?
Yes, Captain Eugene Axtell. I learned later on, 50-some years later, through another E Company boy who came to one of our reunions, he had served in the Pentagon. I said, do you remember Eugene Axtell? Yeah, he said, he served in the Pentagon with me.